welcome to Live Your Own Way with me, Lucy Gleason Interiors, chatting homes, life and inspiration with my very special guests. There is a lot to chat about with my guest, Francesca Rohan-Plowden, today. She's had a really interesting journey in life so far, having trained at Lambda to become an actress. She's been a model, a presenter, and an interior designer working on historical stately homes such as Goodnestone Park, and now also founder of Design Havens for Heroes. It's a brilliant charity where our amazing NHS staff will be receiving room makeovers in their own homes by designers. Literally hundreds of brands offering their paints, furniture, carpet, you name it. So she's a very busy person indeed at the moment. Hi, Francesca.
Hello.
Thanks for catching up with me today, because I know you're really busy with four boys at home and your charity.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to talk to you, so thank you.
There is a lot to talk about today, because obviously, as I've just mentioned, the charity Design Havens for Heroes, but you've had a real journey in lots of different ways, but with your career. Yeah. So I thought we'd just start at the beginning. It's probably the best place to start.
Okay. So yes.
I'm really interested to know about you started acting when you were quite young, and we've got quite similar backgrounds.
I know,
in that
it's
way.
Funny, isn't it? I probably started sort of making money, as it were, from acting when I was about 12. I was always doing it at school, but I went and got myself an agent in High Wycombe. I remember my mum driving me down there when I was around 12 and doing an Oscar Wilde speech. I was quite obsessed by Oscar Wilde at that age. It's a bit bizarre, but anyway. And so I started doing acting, and I used to go for auditions and mainly kind of kids shows, really. But it was quite funny because I had the same agent as James Corden and a few other people. So we used to be in the elevator at the LWT building in the South Bank, always going up for these kids dramas together. And it was just, be like, oh, hello, you again. Oh, hello again. Hello. that kind of gave me the bug for acting. But I was only really allowed to do it in the holidays. And so I used to do commercials and things, and it was just my way of making my own pocket money, which I really enjoyed the independence of. And I suppose that's kind of the foundations of setting up one's own business, I guess, is having independence.
Did you always want to be an actress?
There were three things I always wanted to do, which was I really wanted to be a fashion designer for a long, long time. And I really wanted to be an actress, and I wanted to be a ballerina, but I'm really tall. So I was too tall for a ballerina. And then the fashion designing, I used to just spend hours drawing dresses, and my mum worked in fashion. So I was very much involved in that sort of world. And then I thought it was too competitive. So ironically, I chose acting, which is probably the most competitive profession there is.
That's for sure.
Yeah, I know. So I don't know what the logic was behind that. And so I went to a school in London where acting, it was quite an academic school called Durfan and Latimer, and acting was, it was encouraged, but not as a subject to do. So in those days, you couldn't do drama GCSE or A-level or anything. It was kind of definitely an extra. And it was really the only thing that I actually got excited about at school, other than history of art and art. And so I used to turn up for my acting classes, and I just really didn't pay much attention to the rest of it. And I just thought, this is what I want to do. So yeah, I suppose so. That was kind of, it was just the thing that made me happy during those sort of teenage years.
And you went on to study for 4 years at Lambda, didn't you?
Yes, yeah, so I cut a deal with my dad, who was really upset that I wasn't going to go to university, because all my family are quite academic and gone to university. And I said, look, I'll just do a foundation course in drama, and I'm sure that would get it out of my system, but I really don't want to go to university yet. Can I just do this first? And I was actually looking to do drama. I couldn't decide whether I'd do drama in English or history of art for A-level and for a degree. So I managed to persuade him to let me audition for Lambda, and they just started a foundation course that year. And so I did the foundation course, and obviously I didn't get it out of my system at all. And then I applied while there for the 4-year course at the end of that year. And then I went on to the 4-year course, which was the 3-year course. So I was there 4 years in all, the 3-year course, which was the formal training.
Right.
So I ended up being there for 4 years.
So do you think it's important to go to drama school if you want to be an actor?
Do you know what? It's funny because I don't obviously really act anymore at all. I have a lot of friends who didn't go to drama school. They went to university but got very much involved in the acting scene at university. And then some went to university and then did like a post-grad training, which is a shorter course. I don't think it's important. I mean, lots of people haven't done it. But for me, it was important because there was a lot I didn't know about myself physically. And I think that's really important, and how to access your voice. And so in that sense, I think the training was brilliant. And I learned a lot about Shakespeare, although, you know, we had done it in English at school, but the rhythm and the iambic pentameter and all that sort of thing. But I think I was really young as well. And if I'd gone straight into acting at 18, I think, I don't know what would have happened. It would have been a disaster because you're quite insecure at that age anyway. And yeah. I think it gave me confidence. And it gave me foundations to do it. So in that sense, and it does help, I think, when you're applying for, you know, meeting agents. And, you know, it was a very good way of, you know, you have a showcase at the end of the year. And I was thinking about this year, all the people graduating from drama school and how they haven't had that final showcase and all that kind of thing. So it must be just devastating for them because it's all that training. And then nothing really, I think they're doing video ones instead.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. I hadn't thought of that. But yeah, I guess they'll have to do it by video, won't they?
Yeah, I think they're just doing recordings because I follow Lambda on Instagram. And the three-year course is all built up to the final term this summer where you do the showcases for the agents and the casting directors. So not to be able to do that must be devastating. But obviously the arts is just so massively, like many things, decimated by COVID. So it's going to be very difficult. It's not an easy time to be coming out of drama school or be in the acting profession at all. It's really sad.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, that's a huge subject in itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's massive. So apart from obviously learning your craft of acting at drama school, what else did you take from your time there, do you think?
Some amazing friends who I still see and speak to all the time. And some have become massively successful. Some are still kind of working at it. Some are completely given up and do something completely different. I learned a lot about myself, which I think is, you know, there's a slight element of therapy at drama school. They really make you analyze yourself. So it's quite enlightening in that sense. But it's funny, it's something I talk to my son's schools about how important drama is because, you know, as an interior designer, you know, especially in the commercial areas, you have to pitch a lot and you have to do presentations and you have to stand at, you know, on a site with, you know, normally I'm the only woman and sort of hold your ground and project and say, you know, and I think actually the drama training gave me a foundation of being able to do presentations and to have some sense of confidence in presenting work, be it acting or interior design or, you know, any profession. And I think it's, even if you never go on to act, it's a really good skill to learn. And that's why I think drama is really important in schools because it gives people confidence to be able to talk and project their voice and, you know, to convey their whatever they're trying to say or sell across. And I think in that sense, it's sort of invaluable. But I think it was funny because drama school, we went every day, you know, it was term time. It was like school. It wasn't like universities where you just went to the odd lecture. So you'd often be there from 8 in the morning till 10, 11 at night if you were doing a show. So it was a very close and a very, you know, each year is very small, very close community. And I think I really enjoyed that because I didn't really like my school. So it was, it was a sense of that sort of family, but also just a really good foundation for, you know, going forward in any business, really.
Oh, yeah, I think people often find that with the higher education, that they find their crew, don't they? Because you're all more like-minded.
Well, it's interesting because when they choose a year at drama school, it's like they cast it. So there's one of everybody, basically, and, you know, and there's only one. You know, it was very diverse cast, and people came from completely different backgrounds, and that was really nice because I suppose I learned a lot about people as well. And you're actually, and again, I guess it's very useful for interior design is you have to learn to watch people and understand people. And I remember one of the things they used to make us do was go and sit on Ken High Street for an afternoon, because it was just around, it was in Earls Court. And they say, go and sit at a cafe and watch people. And then you come back and you basically present someone you've seen. So it was a bit stalkerish, but it was, you just had to learn about people. And also, so not only within your class, but also in the wider world. And I think that kind of insight into people's personalities and what makes them tick is quite helpful, especially with interior design, when you have to have quite a close connection with your client and understand what their personality is, what their tastes are, how do they, work, especially with big projects. And so it's quite an interesting way of, learning about people as well.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I sometimes think about acting and interior design, because obviously, I've acted as well before. And I think, to want to act, you sometimes are a bit of a, if this is the right phrase, like a bit of an emotional sponge. Like I can pick up on atmospheres and things like that quite easily. Yeah. And I think that helps as an interior designer, doesn't it?
Totally. And you have to be quite insightful. And I think as an actor, you learn to be insightful into people. With interior design, you really have to be, because otherwise you could deliver something they really don't want.
Exactly.
So in that sense, yeah, it is about people. And I think, it's, if you can learn about people, it doesn't really matter what industry you go in. It would, it's a much, politicians should probably learn a bit more about people sometimes. it's really important skill to have. And I think actors sometimes are some maligned a bit, because people think that it's all about them and showing off. And actually most actors are quite shy, I think.
They are.
And I find it much easier, sometimes pretending to be somebody else than being myself, which is something you learn with age, isn't it? But it's actors most of the time are quite shy, and they're actually just observing people, and that's quite an interesting insight into how you function in other areas of business, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. So you went on to working on stage, didn't you? Was that quite soon after you left drama school?
It was funny, because when I was doing the child acting, I was doing child modelling as well, which I used to get teased terribly about, but I was like, I'm earning some money. And so I left Lambda, and I just really wanted to be on stage. I didn't really have a major craving to be in front of a camera, but I was sort of doing modelling stuff on the side. Because it was supporting me, because the theatre stuff was really not paying at all well. And I did a lot of fringe, which basically was free. And I worked in a lot of cafes and shops. And, basically I lived in Clapham, and I worked my way down the Northcote Road. It was the Gourmet Burger Kitchen had just opened in those days. It was the first one. So I did the burgers, and then I went and worked at the Greasy Spoon, and then I worked at the bar, and then I worked at the pottery shop. And then
I lived in Clapham too. Our lives are very similar.
I know, it's funny, isn't it? I kind of walk down that road now sometimes. I've got a friend around the corner. I'm like, oh God, this brings back so many memories. And I must have had a picture of me behind the desk or something going, this girl won't last here very long. She's very fickle. Is to go from one job to the next, because it wasn't what I wanted to do, but I knew I had to do it. So I thought if I varied these part-time jobs, it would be more interesting. But because I just wanted to be doing theatre, and I kind of really fell in love with the theatre. But it's funny, because I suffer terribly from nerves. So it was slightly kind of self-masochistic in a way, that because I didn't really know why I put myself through it sometimes. I just get so nervous. And filming was much easier, but I don't know why, but I just, yeah. So I did things at the Globe and the Tricycle, and I went on tour a lot. And I guess it was that sense of community as well, which I think you have a bit more in theatre, because you're all running on adrenaline at the same time. Whereas with filming, it's a bit more sporadic. And that sort of feeling when you finished a show and, you all go to the pub together afterwards or something. I think I just loved the life as well. And I ended up marrying an actor, and even when I started having children, but when we was going out with him, he was 10 years older than me and he's much more established. So I used to go meet him after his shows every night. And if I'd been in a show, then we'd meet up in town. And it was just very much a very thespian, rather lovely lifestyle, but it was great fun. And it was a really kind of, interesting time because, you know, there were so many people coming through the ranks, which are now, you know, household names. And it's just fascinating to see how people's careers develop.
Yeah. And you did some presenting as well, didn't you?
Yeah. So the modelling accidentally led into presenting. And one of my modelling gigs is I used to be the fashion, you know, the model who wore the clothes on a programme called Live at Three, which was at UK Living.
I remember it well. I do.
And it was quite good. I can't remember how I fitted it in, but I did somehow. And I used to, so they just turn up and say, right, that's what, you know, you're going to wear that. Today's stylist is so-and-so. They had various celebrity stylists and they're going to talk to you a bit and say, is it comfortable or whatever? But basically don't really say anything. Walk out there, do a turn. And, you know, you might get asked a question. It wasn't particularly challenging. And then one day whoever it was meant to be the person chatting about it, didn't turn up for whatever reason. And they knew me a bit there by then. So they said, well, you just put on the outfit. They're the stuff that we've been sent. You just put them on, go out there and just talk to Jane about what you're wearing. So I just thought, and I guess it helped. They knew I was at drama school. So I just blagged it. And then I kind of did more blagging and did more presenting in that sense. And I remember doing Rise TV and being at the Science Museum at 6 o'clock in the morning, dressed as a Bond girl, talking about a car that I knew nothing about.
Wow, that's dedication, isn't it?
I think they just saw kind of like, well, she'll do it, just across my forehead. But
and it's all been experience, though, isn't it? In one way or another.
Yeah, I think it's just about grafting and getting up early and doing things and doing different things and you know. They're often like that, you know, doing that silly sort of modelling and not saying anything led on to doing some presenting. So often these things lead on to something. And then years later, when I'd had my third son and I was doing fashion styling, a TV producer found me and they said, oh, we're looking for a fashion stylist for this wedding TV. And they said, have you done any presenting? I said, well, I have, yeah. And so just, you know, years later, it led on to another thing. So it was kind of, it's just strange, but...
Yeah. Speaking of which, I was going to ask about, you know, when you had your first baby and then juggling motherhood with theatre, which is all encompassing, isn't it?
Yeah, it kind of just stopped.
Right.
So I think my last, my well, I later went on to set up a theatre company, but my last job where I was, it wasn't my theatre company, was I was pregnant with my first son. And I was Usher doing a play in North London and I probably was about 8 or 9, and I actually did a commercial during that time as well, but 8 or 9 weeks pregnant, and I had terrible morning sickness and I'd go on stage, literally do my lines, run off, throw up and then go back on.
Oh.
And I think, oh, this is a nightmare. And then I had to go and do this commercial in Belgium and it was the height of summer, but it was for the winter. And so I was in heavy, thick clothing with all the reflectors on me. And I kept, and they were all saying sort of in French, what's her problem? Why does she keep throwing up? But I didn't want to tell them I was pregnant because I was worried it was going to affect my insurance. So I just sort of said I had a dodgy mole or something.
The show must go on, isn't it, with acting? You know, you just have to carry on whatever.
Well, yeah, you do. And you kind of, and actually when you're, I was only, how old was I? I was 27 or 26, I think, then. And I, you know, I didn't really know what being pregnant was. You know, I just didn't really know. And I just thought I'd just carry on with normal and act. And then when I had my son, it suddenly dawned on me that actually that was kind of it. You know, I was a mum and I didn't want to leave him. And my husband at the time was an actor and was working in theatre. So it was great because he was around during the day. But in the evenings, he was always going into town to do the shows and then wouldn't come back probably till, you know, midnight or one by the time he got the train and everything. We were in Teddington by that point, Twickenham and Teddington. And, yeah. And then I had my second son 20 months later. And then, I you know, that was really, you know, there was no way we couldn't have childcare or anything, couldn't afford any of that. And So I kind of just gave up and sort of let him do the acting business. And he was doing, you know, quite big TV shows and stuff. So it just seemed to make sense. And I didn't want to leave them and I didn't want to take them away with me. And I didn't, you know, so it was kind of, it was inevitable that it was going to have to come to an end.
Was this the time where you got the opportunity to live within a National Trust place at Lamb's House?
So I'd seen it and I've had to have cesareans for all my kids. I was recovering from my second cesarean and I saw an advert in the Sunday Times and we were paying £1,100 per month for this two up, two down cottage in Teddington.
Yeah, it's very expensive, isn't it, in London?
Yeah. And it was tiny. It was sweet, but really tiny little cottage. And I saw, we'd been to Rye a couple of times for like romantic get days out or weekends or whatever. And I said, isn't that amazing house in Rye that we walked past? And it's a big Georgian manor house. And Dominic was like, yeah, yeah. And I said, it's for rent. And it's the same price as what we're paying here. And I sort of phoned up and I would just like, for years, I've always just got brochures of houses. Even as a child, I used to pretend to be my mother and get pictures and brochures of houses from Country Life. It was really odd, but anyway, I did it. And my mum would be like, why are these multi-million pound houses coming through the house?
That's funny.
And I used to have a box of these houses. I kind of, it was inevitable I was going to end up doing something with old houses, wasn't it?
But yeah.
I used to go, hello, it's Mrs. Rogers here. Could you possibly send me the details?
Yeah, I think your future was pretty carved out.
Yeah, no, it was pretty inevitable. And so I kind of thought I'll do that the same with this National Trust property. So I phoned up, so can I have the details? Probably put on a posh voice. And they said, oh, well, we've got to interview first before we send anything out. And I was like, oh, that wasn't the plan. So I ended up having a phone interview. And then it just sort of spiraled. And then they sent me an application for me. I had to write all these essays. But because I was lying in bed, sort of breastfeeding, not doing anything else, I was like, okay, I'll just do that. And then they said, right, well, 180 people have applied. You're now down to the final 12. And then it was the final six or four or something. And it got to the point, and Dominic was doing a play at the National. And I'd gone down a couple, my parents, because I couldn't drive because of cesarean, had driven me down for an interview. But Dominic couldn't come because he was working. And it got to the point, they said, look, does your husband actually exist? And, you know, we need to meet you both because obviously it's a joint tenancy thing. So we went down very early one morning and he drove and we had this interview and we were down to the final two. And then on the way back, they said, you've got the tenancy and, you know, but you've got to move in within the next 3 months because the house opens to the public.
Wow.
And that was why the rent was so reasonable for what, you know, it's a big 5-bedroom, basically mansion, because we had to run it as a National Trust property. So I turned up and there was like a list of 40 volunteers and they said, right, they like cream tea and, you know,
Oh, I see. So you have to work within the grounds of Lamb's House then if you live there. Basically, is that how it works?
The house was divided into parts that were open to the public. And when we first took it on, it was only, I think it was just two afternoons a week. And by the time we left, it was three full days. But they, you'd have to open it up. You're in charge of basically the curator kind of gave me a course on how to look. You know, there was like a bust of Henry James from the Tate. I had to put on white gloves, polish, you know, do all the sort of housekeeping side. But then I would also have to occasionally do tours for school groups or a lot of American tourist groups used to come over. And then I'd have to run the rota of the volunteers, keep them happy, do the banking. So it was like running a business, basically, sort of a very nice shop. Then we had to look after the garden as well. So that was our responsibility, which was really quite hard work because it was nearly 2 acres. And then, that was my life. And that's where I set up the theatre company.
I'm going to ask you about that, Lamb Players.
Yeah,
is that right?
I can't go to the theatre, so I'll bring it here. So I did. And that ran for about 10 years while we were there. And it was just a really lovely thing to do. We did open air theatre. And there's a lovely guy called Charlie Parsons who, I think he was one of the founders of the Tube. Is it the Tube and the Big Breakfast? And he lived locally.
Yeah, I know. Well, I know of him. Yeah, yeah,
and he lived locally. Someone said he lived locally, and I said I'd like to put some plays on in my garden. Would you mind just, you know, sponsoring it so I could just pay a few actors? And I paid them the minimum equity wage. He very sweetly sponsored it, and I had no idea whether anybody would turn up. We did a poster, and I got these mates along, and I think there was eight or nine of us in the original cast. And Tamara Harvey, who now is a very well-known director, directed it. And people turned up, and then they turned up the next day. And then by the end of it, by, you know, we would do four or five shows a weekend with probably 200 people a show, you know, it was, and then we did a Christmas show. So it just became a cult thing down here.
Was it an outdoor theatre?
Yeah, it was outdoor. And then in the winter, right, we used to do a kind of a concert in the hall at Lamb House, which we could only sit a few people, like 40 in each thing. Whereas the outdoor, we could have up to 200, 250, which, you know, on a good summer's night we would get. And it was really lovely. And it was completely sort of fly by the seat of your pants theatre. You know, it was a bit kind of Basil Hawtey. Things were always going a bit haywire. But people really liked it. You know, there were seagulls, right, suddenly dipping into the thing or making noise or whatever. But the actors had 1 week rehearsal, and they turned, and we normally rehearse at Lambda or Rada or the RSC rehearsal spaces, and they'd have to turn up and know all their lines, and then it was called a guerrilla theatre. They'd rehearse for 3 days, and then they come down to Rye, rehearse for another 2 days, and then on the Friday night we do it.
Right. Amazing. That's kind of like rep, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. And the actors were phenomenally brilliant, and so they could cope with it. You know, it was, we had to cast it with people that we knew would be able to, you know, be completely off book with Shakespeare, you know, and just wham bam, you know, thank you ma'am kind of theatre by the end of it, the week.
Yeah, amazing. And at this point, your home started appearing in magazines, didn't it? So what happened there?
So we were the first family to live at Lamb House since the Lambs in the 18th century. And you know, obviously I'd been an actress and Dominic was an actor, so there was a bit of sort of interest around that. And one day the Telegraph, a guy called Dominic Bradbury, who's a lovely interiors journalist, knocked on the door. And he said, oh, I hear you're living here. You know, can I come and have a look, basically? And I was sort of like, oh, it's a bit odd, but yeah, sure, come in. And he said, I'd really like to do a piece on it and you guys being living here. And it went into the Saturday Telegraph, and the rooms that were open to the public weren't actually allowed to feature in press. So the only pictures that could feature were the rooms that we were living in and that I'd been doing up and decorating. So the feature was all about the private areas of the house that we'd been living in. And then another magazine, I think The Lady and various other Sussex Life, all sorts of magazines started kind of getting in touch, thinking we'd like to do a feature. And that was kind of how it all sort of started. And then locally people said, oh, would you help me with this? And could you do this? And there was a property developer locally said, oh, I really need some help with some flats in a flat I have in Mayfair. And then I have a couple of cottages down here. Would you do them up for the rental? So I just sort of started doing that as a side business. And ironically, I'd always thought about interior design, but I thought I'd have to train. So I'd never really pursued it as an option, as a career. And then suddenly I sort of found myself being paid to do it. So it sort of happened by osmosis. And by that point, my husband and I had split up, and I really needed to earn money, because I still had this National Trust property, which I was in on my own now with two kids. And I just thought, I don't know what I'm going to do. So if people want to pay me to help them choose colours or decorate their houses, then maybe this is what I should be doing. But I think it was a confidence thing, because I'd trained to be an actress. I thought, well, you know, that's, I'm not trained to be an interior designer. Why would anybody want to employ me? So that's kind of how that happened. And then subsequent houses, the journalists were like, well, can I feature that? And can I feature this? And, you know, projects that I did, they said, have you done any houses, or could we have any pictures of that? So it kind of just sort of happened that way.
That's funny. Life is like that, isn't it? Sometimes, you know, it just happens and you go with it and it's meant to be.
Yeah, it is. I think I do think everything happens for a reason. I mean, it sounds a bit, you know, la la maybe, but
oh, I agree.
I think it's just, you know, sometimes in like your darkest moments, the weirdest thing will suddenly happen and you kind of go, okay, well, maybe we just have to go with that.
Yeah.
And I didn't really kind of accept myself as doing interior design until I got asked to pitch for Goodnestone Park, which I got asked to do with a friend of mine, Marcus Crane, who's also in Rye. And we'd both been suggested by a mutual friend to the client, and it was so huge that we were like, oh my God, I don't think we could do that. I could do that on my own. He's like, I don't think I could do that. Let's pitch for it together. And he had an interior shop, And suddenly we, you know, we found ourselves with this very big Charles Sevier firm, you know, and an architect and all sorts of panel in London and Regent Street, and this very smart office holding these mood boards, which were very avant-garde, and pitching for this massive stately home with a huge budget. And we got it. And that was kind of when I went, okay, this is time to set up a business properly.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to ask you about the process of working on kind of stately homes, because it must be, you know, there must be so much to think about.
Yeah, it is. It's I've definitely learned on the job. And I think the clients very sweetly knew that with Goodnestone Park. It's I guess being at Lamb House and working alongside the National Trust of the curation and everything, that it was kind of a good training, and I learned a lot about, you know, there was a lot of repairs to the windows, and I was there, you know, I had to be involved in all the meetings about that with the trust. There was a lot of, you know, exterior works. There was a lot of interior renovation that needs to, so I learned a lot of stuff doing, you know, being there at Lamb House. But yeah, I mean, I didn't know a lot about it in other aspects when we started Goodnestone Park. I didn't know about bats, for example. There was a huge issue with the bats. They're protected, and if they're there, you can't wait to move them until another time. And, you know, that was a massive delay. There was a lot of things of the English heritage that we had to address. And, you know, planning, I'd never put in planning applications before with English heritage and things like that. So, you know, we worked the architect on that, and that was quite, a quick learning process. But it's with all the historic houses I've done subsequently, it's always about the story of the house that inspires me. And I think that's kind of why, I guess it's sort of a bit like the acting. I like to tell the story of the house and bring it up to date, but it's nods to its history and its traditional in sense of the interiors. But, you know, if you scratch at these big houses, there's incredible stories behind them. And especially if they're commercial, like the Leeds Castle, there wasn't a client per se. So, you know, they basically said, you know, just make it look beautiful so we can rent it out.
Was that Battle Hall?
Yes, that was Battle Hall. Yeah, so there wasn't, you know, it wasn't particularly about anyone's personal taste, which Goodnestone, you know, is very much was a family home, and they had all these incredible stories of their family. With Battle Hall, there was no particular client. You know, there's about 13, 14 trustees, and, you know, all very different ideas. So I made my client the previous owner of Leeds Castle, which is a lady called Lady Bailey, who's no longer alive. I had a dead client, but she was my inspiration, and I took what she had done in the 20s and 30s when she put the actual castle through this massive renovation into my kind of, you know, my inspiration and how I was going to approach Battle Hall. So she loved chinoiserie, she loved birds, which is why I went for the De Gournay wallpaper and the Lewis and Wood Dove wallpaper. She liked marble bathrooms. She liked quite like modern technology being mixed in. She sort of became my client, because I think, you know, and there were so many fascinating stories about that time that she had Leeds Castle and indeed Battle Hall, that that kind of is a really good way of approaching you know, interiors of old houses. I think people sometimes just want to impose their feelings and their thoughts and their tastes, and actually it often jars, however lovely it is, it doesn't. And whereas if you actually take the stories of the house and the property and the people who've lived in it before as the inspiration, somehow it kind of mellows into it more.
Right, yeah. So what's the biggest challenges you've found working with stately homes?
Bats. Yeah. Bats, medieval niches. At Battle, the De Gournay wallpaper, well, actually De Gournay wallpaper there in Goodnestone, it's really lovely, but it has to go on special treated walls, basically. And in Goodnestone, it turned out that they suddenly realised that what they thought was dry wall was completely damp, and therefore we couldn't put this beautiful wallpaper on it. So that was an issue. But at Battle Hall, it's all bespoke. And so unlike normal wallpaper where you buy it by the roll and then you have to cut bits out to fit it around the door or the fireplace or whatever, it's all done in elevations. So they take elevations of the room, and then the designers bespoke so that you don't like cut off the bird's head or whatever. So it's completely bespoke to the room. So you could have it that, you know, you've got some roses or creepery or birds coming round the side of the mirror if you've given them the dimension of the mirror. You know, so it's really, you know, you're not cutting bits out. So we'd worked on that quite intensively. And then, you know, the builders are in there and then suddenly a medieval niche would appear. So we'd have to go back to the drawing board and redesign these panels so that, we, you know, because obviously we couldn't ignore a 14th century medieval niche.
No, of course not.
So, yeah, so that's been quite challenging. I fell through the floor there as well. That was an interesting day.
Were you okay?
I was fine. It was more comedy, and I was so mortified that I didn't want the CEO of Leeds was having a tour, and All the floorboards were up, and there was that sort of insulation that goes between the rafters, and this, I don't know. I just presumed that there was flooring underneath it, so I stepped on the foam bit accidentally, and just ended up going into the dining room below. And my assistant Amy, bless her, came up the stairs, basically just seeing my torso above the floor, and pulled me out. But you know, I was quite smartly dressed because it was the day the CEO was doing a tour. It was just you know, comedy moment. But yeah, I'm much more careful now walking around more houses.
Yeah, you live and learn, don't you?
Yeah, you do. Yeah. Unfortunately, you didn't see. It was that kind of thing of brushing myself off and going, yes, anyway, Dad, would you like to go see the bathroom?
Yeah, it's a proper comedy gold moment, that.
Yeah, I've had quite a few of those. Yeah.
So, right, let's talk about Design Havens for Heroes.
Yeah.
Because it's you know, it's become really big really quickly. Yes. And how did it come about in the last 3 months or so?
I did realise the other day, it was just after the Easter weekend, which I hadn't kind of put two and two together. I don't know if it's relevant or not really, but we'd gone into lockdown quite early on. So my son's birthday is on the 7th of March. And I think that was the last time we'd gone up to London and had to take him out for lunch and see my parents. And we went into lockdown probably about 4 or 5 days after that. It's around the 14th, I think. And maybe earlier, and my partner's high risk, and I have a friend who's Italian, and I saw what was happening in Italy, and she was telling me what's happening in Italy, and I, you know, I just thought this is inevitable. It's gonna come to the UK, and we just didn't want to risk it. So I took the kids out of school a bit earlier because of David being high risk, and we just sort of went, right, this is what we're just gonna do. And I'd probably been locked down about a month or so. We'd had Easter. And I was really struggling with, you know, what kind of my purpose was, in the sense of I really wanted to help. Maybe it's that empathetic thing that you were saying about being an actress or something. I don't know. I just felt, I don't feel like sort of pitching or pushing interior design or anything is appropriate right now. And actually the same friend, the Italian friend, was delivering food into the hospitals, and Amy who works with me, she was making scrubs and masks, and I just thought, I just wish I could do something to help, you know, what's happening. And I'd been watching it on the news, and I suppose, you know, feeling frustrated and scared, but living in a high risk household, I think it maybe gave me more impetus to try and do something positive to kind of distract as well. I thought if I could give back, you know, then it's some element of control and sort of make, you know, understanding the situation. I don't really know what it was, but anyway, I was in the bath, and I just thought, oh, I wish I just had, you know, wish I could just think of something that I could possibly do. I just felt really useless. And I've said it before, it was genuinely like a light bulb moment. I just thought, I'll do room makeovers for the NHS when they come out of this. I can't do anything now, but I can do something afterwards. And I sent a couple of messages to Amy, who I work with, and my carpenter guys, friends who are local, and a couple of small fabric suppliers, because I thought, you know, no big brands are going to want to get involved in this. It's just a little idea I'm having in the bath. And they all said yes. So I was like, oh, that's interesting. So the next day I set up an Instagram account. I just thought, I'll just do that and I'll chat about it on there. And I'll just sort of start plodding along with the view that I'd probably do a few room makeovers. I'm near Hastings for the Conquest Hospital nurses and doctors there. And within 3 days, it had gone viral on Instagram. And that was kind of it, basically.
And within, I say weeks, even days, you had something like, well, hundreds of designers, hundreds of brands, and you know, hundreds of nominations as well, didn't you?
When I said that was kind of it, I'm just sort of trying to think what basically what happened.
So much happened.
Day three, my Instagram crashed. My personal one, at Francesca Rimpowden, which is just my businessy one. And Design Havens one that I'd set up the day before, or 2 days before, crashed as well, which was odd because it only had like 50 followers. And it was a Friday night, and I thought, something's going on here. What's going on?
Yeah.
And suddenly I had 300 messages and from designers, and a few influencers had picked up on it. Paula from Hill House Vintage and Amy from Little House London, neither of whom I knew at the time, had obviously shared it, along with Julia, I think it might have been. Julia Alexander might have shared it then. I sort of spoke to her probably on that third or fourth day. And suddenly I was on the phone to Kate Watson Smythe and brands and all sorts of people saying, we want to get involved. And I thought, gosh, I had no idea that this was going to happen. And now we have over 500, I don't know, maybe nearly 600 brands on board. And, 400 designers and, thousands or so nominations have come through. So it's really taken off. And I think it's, I don't know, you're on the team. I think it's tapped into a nerve or a feeling that other people in the interior design industry were feeling, which was, how can we possibly help during this pandemic or after this pandemic? And it's also the interior industry hadn't really given back much. I know individual brands have done it, but maybe as a collective, it hadn't really happened. And maybe it's like a cast and a play, isn't it? If one person, works really hard on the show and other people get involved, it's a collective thing. And I think it's all about teamwork. And I suppose that's what I like about it, because it's like a theatre company in a sense. Everyone's got the same mission and vision, and therefore it kind of picks up its own momentum. Rather than just being one person. And I think the power of Instagram is incredibly strong. And I didn't realise that before now. And it's completely testament to how much people wanted to give back to the NHS.
Yeah, and I mean, the brands that have got on board, what I've found really nice is, there's big sort of department chain shops, or all the way down to boutique.
Yeah,
stores and artists, and it's just a lovely mixture of all sorts of people and
I
brands.
Think that's really I think maybe in all areas that's a really nice thing that's come out of this pretty awful time, which is, and I use as you've probably seen on Instagram, I use the hashtag "We're in this together," because it's not about just the big players, it's also about the little small independent businesses and how and why shouldn't they work together, just as it's there's some really well-known famous interior designers on board and then some ones who are just starting out, and why shouldn't they work together? And it's kind of a huge demographic of people from now we've branched out of interior design and we've got actors and Twiggy is a patron and things like that.
We've got Dominic Cooper as well, isn't there?
Althwaite, and then we've got Natalia from She Dreams of Gucci, which is, she's a sort of lifestyle influencer, and she's helping get brands and boards for the hampers. And yeah, Dominic's going to be doing a room, and Tamsin's going to be doing a room, and my very good friend Carly Lawson, who's Twiggy's daughter, she's designing a t-shirt. She used to design for Stella McCartney, which is going to be part of World Rainbow Day. Really creative people have got together behind this, and I think that's sort of what's really lovely about it, because it's a massive hub of creativity, and I would like to say I'd thought of all angles of it when I had that idea in the bath, but I hadn't. It was literally a very simple idea. But from that, we, you know, we are going to be supporting trades. From that, we are reducing waste within the interiors industry by saying, look, we'll take your showroom stock, or we'll take your damaged cans of paint or whatever it is, because it's still perfectly good quality. And, you know, we're raising awareness for the NHS, and it seems to be something that the NHS really want, you know, be it in their homes or their hospital staff rooms, which we're going to do as well. So it's kind of, it sort of evolves each day. And as you know, you know, sort of we go off on a tangent sometimes and go, what about so-and-so? What about this? And then they say yes. And then it's like, oh, that's brilliant, because it's opened up another, you know, the fact that beauty brands are now getting on board to donate to the hampers. You know, it's not just about interior design anymore, which is really lovely, because, you know, all those elements tie in together with it being the importance of home.
Yeah. And how are you finding it? Because you're kind of at the helm of it all with all the coordination.
but really enlightening as well. And I feel very passionate about it. I suppose, you know, I've created three things in my life, which are my children, a theatre company, and by accident, you know, Design Haven Three Roads. And I sort of, I feel very determined to just keep it going as long as we possibly can, and for it to be such a positive and happy experience for everybody involved. And it is, it's not going, it's going, it's gone in a fast pace, in the sense that lots of people are joining quickly, but you know, I really want to do it properly. And you know, it's, you know, so I speak to lawyers, I speak to people about GDPR, I speak to all these things, just so it's all the nuts and bolts are in place and all the cogs are turning, because it is really important to me that it functions properly, so that we can do as many rooms as possible, but so it's all positive. And it is a long-term charitable initiative. And in that sense, it's kind of, I'm really passionate about it, but it has slightly taken over my life, to be honest. But that,
well, I can imagine, how can it not?
But that's a good thing, because I think I was slightly struggling with just doing up lovely houses with huge budgets, and maybe only a certain sector of people appreciating those. And I think this way, and that's completely honest, and maybe too honest, but I think this way, this is about interior design being available for everybody.
Yeah, as it should be.
As it should be. And I actually, you know, if anything, it's made me veer more towards that, because I think I've always, you know, I've been very lucky that I've done these beautiful houses, but, you know, they're all for rent, and, you know, they are an exclusive experience and things like that, or their weddings, which, you know, people obviously save lots of money for, but then it's a once in a lifetime experience. And I sort of always think, well, actually, everybody's home, wherever you live and whatever you live in, whether you own it or you rent it, or it's a studio flat or it's a Georgian manor, I don't know, it's equally as important. And everybody, whatever your taste is, you know, it's only people's opinions, and, you know, who says what's good or bad taste, whatever it is, you still really, if you really like something and that's what you want in your home, then that's what you should have. And I think its interior design should accommodate everybody. And I think that's a nice thing about Design Havens, is that we, like you say, we've got the small brands, we've got the big brands, there's a complete array of different tastes and styles and, you know, interests and influences, and, you know, there's something for everybody. And I think that's how it should be.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned a little while ago about World Rainbow Day. It's October the 2nd, isn't it?
October the 2nd. And this is, this is just genius. And it's, and I can't take any credit for it. Hattie Hatfield is her Instagram handle, which is called Emma. And she's one of our designers on Design Havens. And her daughter, her 10-year-old daughter, Tilly, I think inspired by Design Havens and being a little girl in lockdown, thought it'd be really nice to, she just came up with the idea basically, to give back with the idea of World Rainbow Day. And I know my boys have often have days at school where you pay a pound and they wear, I don't know, red or spots or something for Red Nose Day, or blue for a charity, or green for a charity or whatever. And World Rainbow Day is the children are going to pay a pound to wear rainbow colours. So basically, it's pretty, you know, expansive. You could wear whatever. And we are going to get brands involved. I know that Emma's got a lot of quite a few businesses who are going to do rainbow themed window displays and donate money to the Rainbow Day for that. And we are doing the t-shirt, which is going to be the Design Havens t-shirt, which we will sell throughout the year, but we're going to launch it alongside World Rainbow Day. And basically the money will go towards Design Havens, because although everybody is donating their time and products for free, there is a lot of things that we can't cover the costs for, such as the trades, because a lot of them can't give their time for free, which is completely understandable. But also there's quite a lot of logistics, as you know, from getting the product from one place to the other, and transport and
storage.
A lot of storage, because a lot of the brands are having to shift the stuff out of their warehouses to make room for new stock. So the funds will go towards that, and you know, and hopefully also go towards some of the things that will need money in the hospital rooms as well. So it's, you know, it's you know, what I've realized is running a charity sort of initiative is that, you know, a lot can function for free, but you still need to raise funds for it as well. And this is a really lovely way of people supporting Design Havens, who aren't necessarily also in interior design or celebrities or whatever. They can support it by just donating a pound or more if they choose. But it's getting them involved, because actually, you know, they've also got homes and want to, you know, help support the NHS by having havens to retreat to. And I think it's really nice to have children involved as well. And seeing that the ideas come from a little girl,
it's lovely.
Yeah, it's a brilliant idea. And it ties in really beautifully, obviously, with the NHS and the rainbow aspect of it, but also, you know, just, I think we will do some kids' rooms as well, but also just children, I think, you know, you've probably found it with yours, is, you know, their homes are really important for them at this time.
They're spending a lot more time, obviously, in there, so absolutely.
So it's kind of interesting to see that a child has come up with that idea of supporting Design Havens, because obviously they've realised how important people's homes are to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if, you know, for anyone listening, there is the Instagram, Design Havens for Heroes. And also there's a website as well, isn't there, which is .org.uk at the end of it.
And World Rainbow Day also has its own Instagram account, which is World Rainbow Day. And if you get in touch with them, they can send the packs out for the schools to get behind it, all the brands or businesses. So Emma's running all that side. But we've got, she's had a lot of schools signed up already.
And brilliant.
Nice.
Yeah. So the first rooms, obviously one has been done already, hasn't it?
One's happening. Yeah. Actual, you know, they've ordered the paint and the sofa, and I don't think they've gone and done the install yet, but it's all the mood boards and everything's done, and it's all been chosen and specified. So it's just a matter of getting it in place now, which now lockdown's ease is going to be a lot easier.
Yes.
And then we've just picked the first cluster. Where I think it's, you know, it's that sort of thing we're saying, you know, we're doing this methodically and carefully rather than just doing, you know, hundreds all in one go. We're going to do them in clusters. So we've picked the first cluster of nominees now. So there's another four or five coming with the designers. So we're just getting in touch with them, and basically it's like a dating agency. We're matching them up with their designer, and they're going to start communicating. I did think, golly, if we could get the software that dating agency uses,
that's next on the list.
Yes, there must be some kind of software that could make some of this a bit simpler. But it is like dating, isn't it? You know, but you know, it's done them logistically. So that's what's happening. So last week I was going through the nomination team, the nominations for the areas that we were looking at. And it's a really sober reminder of why we're doing this. You know, sometimes you get caught up on all the brands and the excitement of, oh, so and so's come on board and la la la, and isn't this fun? And then and just seeing the rooms that they've sent in and their stories and what they've been through during this period and continue to go through and have in the past is really eye-opening, but also really heartwarming, because their resilience and their bravery is just extraordinary, but also how important their homes are to them. So it's really lovely to get to that stage now where we're beginning to get, you know, get the rooms going.
Yeah. And where do you see Design Havens for Heroes going in the next sort of year or two? Because I think there are potentially other plans, aren't there?
I think we would like to go in to do some hospital rooms, definitely, hospital staff rooms and wellness rooms. And I think that's kind of the long-term aim. I think that's going to be more complicated, obviously, because of the restrictions of hospitals and getting access, and you know, there's different trusts and different guidelines of different trusts. So that's something that is sort of on the background, going on slowly. And I think that would be a really nice way of, because you know, obviously, one room a lot of people can benefit from. But just to have to just keep doing the rooms, really, and you know, it's becoming an ongoing charity, I think, is really the main aim. Just as lots of other charities function and supporting. And, you know, people said, oh, could you do key work? I mean, all of it is really possible, providing we have enough designers and brands on board. But, you know, various brands are interested in being long-term partners, which would be fantastic. And supporting small businesses and trades in the industry would be really lovely. But I suppose just sort of in the sense of joining everybody together as well on a long-term basis, I think is really important.
It's very exciting, really, that, you know, everything that, you know, we could potentially do. I'm really enjoying it, being part of the team.
Well, it's lovely working with Lucy on it, and you've been brilliant getting loads of brand.
Oh, thanks.
Really good.
Great. So I was going to say, we've discussed other people's havens, but I just want to briefly talk about yours, because I've seen some of it on Instagram and it's beautiful.
Well, there's snippets.
Snippets.
That was the battle I won in lockdown. That was my victory, was finally getting to paint my front door pink with living in a house with five males. It was really, I think they thought, all right, we better give mum a bit of a break.
Fair enough.
Cooking quite a lot, cleaning quite a lot, let her have a pink door.
Not much to ask.
Yeah, no, exactly. I did feel like, you know, it's my house, I'll paint the door pink. But what's my haven?
What's your personal taste?
I think I'm a bit double-sided, because I do really love all the beautiful, sumptuous, chintzy fabrics and all the colour, and especially the styles I use in my sort of stately home and historic houses. I personally don't have the budget for that in my own home so much. So I do have elements of that. I'm very into fabrics, and my mum was a fabric importer and a textile designer, predominantly for fashion, which is why I said, you know, I grew up in the fashion world. But she, so I was always surrounded by really beautiful fabrics, and we had an attic just full of rolls and rolls and rolls of fabric, which I now have a basement full of rolls and rolls of fabric. But so I love texture and colour and print. But funny enough, the house that I live in now, I rented it from my second marriage. I rented it, and it was really quite run down and covered in 70s sort of colours, not nice colours, really sort of dirty, slightly nicotine stained colours, and had no sort of curtains or anything. And I rented it, and I sort of managed to get quite a good deal, because I had left the family home, and I said, can I just, you know, paint it and make it look nice, and in the end you can rent it out for a bit more, kind of thing, which is often what I used to do when I was acting. I used to do up the houses I was renting, and they'd always get a better rent when I left. But so I just whitewashed it, and I actually got some IKEA white curtains, and Amy, who I keep referring to, who makes curtains for me, she cut off the tabs at the top, pinch pleat them and double line. So now I have these really beautiful thick white curtains, but they basically work at about £2 a meter.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can do, isn't it?
And I just bought stuff because I'd left all my furniture and basically belongings behind, and you know, the boys and I just left, and we completely started from scratch. And funny enough, it's so different. It's very seasidey, and it's very different from the work I do, but it's kind of a lot of effort has gone into kind of making something out of nothing. And therefore, you know, I've got a really lovely sofa.com green sort of buttoned ottoman, which I got off eBay, which was brand new. I've got a made.com sofa that I got in a flash sale. And it's that sort of sense of achievement of kind of getting things, you know, bargains and things like that, that really kind of it sort of makes your home a bit more special sometimes, I think, than just throwing loads of cash at it. But and I suppose that's my bedroom is my haven, because it's unlike a lot of things I post, it's all white. I've got a thing about mosquito nets, although we don't live in the tropics.
You never know.
You never know. I've got and then I've just sort of found, I've got some nice cushions from Ocker that I got when I had, you know, saved some pennies. And then I've got lamps from HomeSense and my granny's chest of drawers that I managed to get back. And, you know, just weird things like that. But it's very serene and very coastal calm, which is funny because a lot of the work I do is very patterned and colourful. And it's almost like it's a sort of antidote to kind of just me relaxing and just everything being very calm with all the chaos of the children and work and everything else.
I love your Airbnb place.
Yeah, the beach house. Yeah, well, that's lovely. And again, that was, so that my ex-husband basically runs that, but we're occasionally allowed to go and stay, which is nice. And that was all done on a very, very tight budget. And again, it's that sort of sense of achievement of, you know, I've talked about the lights that I found off the pavement, off the street. And someone said to me the other day, where's off the street, thinking it was a shop?
No, I said, it was outside the shop, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was outside a cafe in St. Leonard's, and they'd obviously ripped them out of their kitchen and they were just free on the pavement. They just said, please take me, kind of thing. So, so I said, no, they genuinely are off the street. And then the scaffold boards, and then actually I found that this other charity called the Hastings and Bexhill Recycle Project, and I think I can't remember how I found them, but it was, you know, there was obviously I saw a table in, there's a lovely shop in St. Leonard's called The Shop, and this table was made from the old Hastings Pier because it burnt down, but they managed to reclaim a lot of the wood that wasn't burnt. And the Hastings and Bexhill Recycle Project were making furniture out of the reclaimed wood. And what the project is when people come out of prison, they retrain them as carpenters and furniture makers so that they can, you know, get back into society and start earning money and rebuild their lives. And they're fantastic, the things that they make. And that the long table in the sunroom, as it were, the beach house, had to be very narrow because it's quite a narrow space, but it needed to sit 10. So they still had some of this wood left over from the pier. And so that was a bespoke made table that I worked with them on, you know, and the benches go right underneath because you couldn't have chairs because otherwise you wouldn't be able to walk around it and that kind of thing. And then they also made the kitchen counter unit. So they basically, we got Howden's basic cabinetry, and then they made the cladded the doors, which was all again reclaimed wood. It's some scaffold boards, some from the pier, some from other reclaimed places. So I suppose it was more imaginative than just going to a shop. And actually sometimes when you are on a really tight budget, you do kind of challenge yourself like that, and sometimes it's a bit more satisfying, I think, doing it like that.
Yeah, I love the island. It's really beautiful. It's not obvious, isn't it? I think I remember hearing you say that you didn't want it to look too much like a kitchen.
No, it's funny because I'm not a massive. I do really like kitchens, and there's some wonderful kitchen companies out there. But I'm not a massive fan of a kitchen looking like a kitchen, which I don't really know why and where it comes from. So I really don't like overhead cupboards. I always go for open shelving if there is anything. And I think it's because I don't really like the look of machines, especially because they're always in white plastic or whatever. And so it's almost, for me, it's always a challenge to sort of make a kitchen be really functional, because you know, it's really nice to have a functioning kitchen, but for it not to look like you're just looking at a whole load of, you know, appliances. And I think that island was to kind of, I wanted it to look like a piece of furniture. And then obviously I put the appliances in that utility space and covered them with curtains and stuff. But all that was in that island is the hob. And again, I just wanted it to be really smooth. So it just sort of flowed into the wood, and there's an oven, and then there's a tiny little sink, but there's a lot of storage in it. But it is, I think it comes from the history of houses and how kitchens didn't really used to look like kitchens.
It's really beautiful, and you can see more pictures on your website, and I've popped a few on mine as well. Yeah. So,
I set up this new page called Francesca's Coastal Living, which is basically more about my life by the beach and less about my life working in stately homes and historic houses, because
it's very calming.
It's calming, and it's I was putting it on my normal Instagram, and people were really reacting, commenting, and I thought, this doesn't really make sense, does it, with all these sort of stately homes and, you know, very fancy interiors, of just seeing me, you know, cladding in a pair of shorts. So I've sort of just set it up as a separate thing, because I guess, like I say, there's sort of two sides to me, and that's very much who I am, is just living by the sea with a load of feral boys.
Well, yeah, it's probably the perfect antidote to everything else, you know, how busy your life is, to be able to just go and wander down to the beachfront. I'm very envious.
It was funny. I always had this craving to live by the sea, and obviously with Lamb House, we had that opportunity. And then when my first marriage fell apart, I didn't know, I'd only been here 2 years. I didn't know anybody. And my eldest was just about to start at nursery, and the nursery was on a farm, and they did lambing, and it's in a farm that looks towards the coast. And I'd been looking at all these nurseries in London, you know, the year before, which were sort of under flyovers and in people's basements. And I just thought, I can't go back to London. I've got to keep him at this nursery where he's going to do lambing. It was one of the reasons I stayed. And I actually, you know, I think as soon as your kids do start to go to nursery and things, if you've moved to a new area, you begin to make friends. But it was just basically me and them by the sea. And it was just, it was the complete antidote to sort of divorce and your world slightly falling apart. And then really appreciating that actually I could have a much simpler, happy life by the sea. And they'd do lambing. Right. They did learn to write their names as well, but and I think I'm really, there was a discussion I had with my girlfriends, or my Lambda friends, who are all still in London, going, just come back, Frankie, just come back, you know, we're all here, you're going to be all on your own down there. And I was very, very tempted to go back to London, but I knew I'd be going back to a really tiny little flat, and you know, it'd be really hard. And I'd sort of had I got the sea bug by then. So, you know, I'm really pleased that I stayed down here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, I could talk to you for hours and hours, but you need to get back to your work and your boys. So thank you so much for today. And I'm at the end of this, I'm going to obviously mention website details and things like that.
Thank you so much, Lucy, for asking me to come and chat with you. I love chatting with you. So it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed today. If you'd like to know more about Design Havens for Heroes, then there's Instagram, Design Havens for Heroes, and you can nominate friends and family from the NHS on there. They also have a website, designhavensforheroes.org.uk. Francesca's website is rowanplowden.com, and you can also see some of her work on my blog too, Lucy Gleason Interiors, which is lucylovesyou.com. Next week, I'm discussing bringing nature into your home with the subject of biophilia, with best-selling author Sally Coulthard. Does bringing nature, such as plants and natural materials, into your home make us happier humans? It's a really interesting topic. Until then, have a good one.